I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Today we'll hear from Grammy Award-winning classical guitarist Jason Viau. He joined us last year to tell us about how he got started playing his instrument, giving us insight into his technique and performing live in our studio. And we'll hear about the history of the most popular board game in history, Monopoly. Our guest, Mary Pallon, went into the dramatic and complicated backstory of the game when her book, The Monopolists, was published. But first, we'll hear from memoirist Jeanette Walls. Her book, The Glass Castle, is currently in the development stages of becoming a motion picture. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. Memoir is tricky. The author needs to be confident that their story is interesting and that there's a lesson to be learned from their life. Jeanette Walls, who rose to prominence as a gossip columnist for MSNBC, detailed her difficult and nomadic childhood in her first book, The Glass Castle. It stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 100 weeks, and now it's currently in the preliminary stages of becoming a motion picture, another testament to how compelling her story is. She joined us back in 2009 to talk about another book, Half Broke Horses, which detailed her grandmother's life. But in our conversation, she did discuss The Glass Castle. Let's listen.
In the opening of The Glass Castle is you in a taxi cab on your way to a very lovely New York City party. You look out the window, and there you see your mother rooting through the garbage.
Right. And it was...
Like we see homeless people.
Well, because she was at the time. She was... And it was a secret for me because I was so ashamed of my life and ashamed of my past. And here I had this la-di-da job, you know, covering celebrities. And I thought if people knew the truth about me, that I would lose everything. I just thought they would be so disdainful of me. My entire life had been the daughter of the town drunk. And finally I had this life that I'd always dreamed of. But I'd lived it with shame and fear that the secret about me would come out. And so I finally did go ahead and come clean in The Glass Castle. And it made me realize what a knucklehead I'd been to be ashamed of it. But this very wise man told me, he said, you know, secrets are like vampires. They suck the life out of you, but they can survive only in the darkness. And once they're exposed to the light, there's the moment of horror, but then they lose their power over you.
Well, secrets also force people to live a kind of, not phony life, but an artificial, you're acting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it made me realize, you know, how it was a phony life for me. I was pretending to be something that I wasn't. So coming clean has just been so emancipating.
And are you surprised? I mean, that book came out a couple of years ago, but surprised at the kind of reaction that people had to your life and your family?
I am stunned.
to this day after 4 years?
Oh, my gosh. And one of the shocking things is the number of people who come up and tell me their stories now. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're crying. And they say, I've never told anybody this before. I'm so ashamed. And I think, why would you be ashamed of that? That's such a great story of survival and strength. And I remember, oh, yeah, I was ashamed too.
I notice in the acknowledgments to this book, Half Broke Horses, you don't acknowledge your father.
No.
You acknowledge him. You thank your mother. You thank your brothers and sisters, extended family members, but not your dad.
Yeah. You know, he's not part of that story. Well, he is part of it. He does appear at the end.
He does.
But this is an homage to Lily. And I thought it would be a bit of a smack in the face to Lily to include her big bete noire in it. Yeah.
And your dad today?
My dad's passed.
He's passed.
Yeah.
When did he die?
In 94.
In 94. Mm-hmm. And what did he die of?
Alcoholism, basically. You know, he pretty much died on the streets drinking.
In New York?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He and my mother were living in an abandoned building at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you were living on Park Avenue?
Park Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Hard to imagine.
It's bizarre to me.
And you knew they were there?
Yes, and I'd offered them help multiple times. And my dad was insulted that I've tried to help him. He said, the dad is supposed to take care of the daughter. And he was a man, you know, with a lot of pride despite all of his many, many flaws. And to this day, I sort of love him. And I wonder if he were alive with my new heightened state of awareness, if I could help him in his alcoholism. But I have to sort of accept that you can't help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. Mm-hmm. And you know, at one point when I was 10 years old, I asked him to stop drinking. He actually tried very hard. He tied himself to the bedpost. But he just, He couldn't do it. He couldn't free himself of the beast.
I think listeners that have read The Glass Castle want to know about your siblings, about what happened to them, where are they, how did their lives end up?
My kid sister, who was just, she had so much going for her, and she was the one who had the toughest adulthood.
Lorraine.
My kid sister's Maureen.
Maureen, excuse
me. You know, that was the toughest part of writing The Glass Castle, is how much of her story to include. And but one of the many blessings as a result of the book is I'd lost touch with Maureen, but after the book came out, we're back in touch, and she's living in California. She's not setting the world on fire with her career, but she's living in a clean, safe place. I've been trying to convince her to come live with me in Virginia. I've got plenty of room, but she says she never wants to live where it's cold ever again.
What happened to Maureen?
She had a bit of a breakdown. At one point, she stabbed my mother. And she ended up leaving and just wanted nothing more to do with the family. She was just fed up with everything. And it's so heartbreaking to me because she was just one of these, everything was sort of golden for her.
Yeah.
And
she had a lot of friends.
And the cutest of us and the smartest of us. And everything just seemed easier to her. And she just reached a breaking point and just wants nothing to do with it. And her life is a little, if any of the siblings have followed in my parents' footsteps, it's been Maureen.
Really?
Yeah.
Even though she stabbed her mother, obviously out of, frustration, anger?
I think the last time I talked to Maureen, she said, Mom was never a mother. And she has a point, but that's still not a reason to stab her. But I am trying to get Maureen to come live with me.
Right. In which case, she'd be with her mother.
Well, I've got another little place to put her in a bag. And I think I might have to accept that she'll never accept my help on that. My older sister, Lori, is still living in Manhattan. She's still an artist, making a living from that. And my brother, who had become a police officer, a Gestapo, as my parents called it, has retired. And he's now a ninth grade English teacher. And I'm so proud of him. He's such a great teacher. I think good teachers are saints walking the planet. And he's a fabulous teacher. He's teaching in a rough area in Brooklyn. And he was told, you know, if you can get these kids not to mug you, it's a miracle. And the kids adore him. Mr. Walls, can I come hang with you after class? And, you know, and it's just, he's really gotten through to them, I think, because of his own tough background. He understands some of the things that they're going through and doesn't look down at them or treat them as somehow inferior.
Do you feel like you had, I'm picking my words here, well, certainly neglectful parents. I mean, there's no question about that. Wouldn't you say?
I don't think so.
But you
maybe
don't think so?
Neglectful in certain ways, and in other ways, incredibly rich in giving. I've been fascinated by readers' reactions to my parents, because in terms of the material things, they were horribly neglectful. I mean, we went hungry. Mm-hmm. We were cold. We lived like animals.
You
it was
did.
Disgusting. On the other hand, I was reading before I was 3 years old. They spent a lot of time with us. They always talked to us about the stars and about history and geology. I was at an event one time, and some readers were in a fight over my parents. They wanted to more than half the room thought that they were terrible parents. And a couple of people were voraciously defending my parents. And the one who was most vocally defending my parents had been born and raised on Fifth Avenue. And her father was a wealthy industrialist, and her mother was a socialite. And she said, if my father had one time taken us children out and discussed the stars with us, or if my mother had one time said, don't worry what other people think of you, my life would have been entirely different. So I think that my parents were certainly flawed, but I believe they also had gifts that they offered us. And I think everything in life is both a blessing and a curse, and it's entirely up to us which one we choose to focus on. And certainly we were taught to fend for ourselves way early on, too early sometimes, and you can sit around feeling sorry for yourself about that, or you can say, you know something, I learned a lot from it, and I'm very happy with where I am in my life right now, so why regret and resent? Mm. Whether you not you want to label it neglect or abuse, I mean, some people have said you were an abused child.
And whether DHS, you know, would have taken the kids away from...
Yes,
from
they probably would have.
Knowing the conditions that you were living
Absolutely,
in.
Absolutely, they probably would have. Would I have been the better for it? I have no way of knowing. I'm glad that they didn't because I'm happy with where I am.
Yeah, but do you think Maureen has a different view
Absolutely.
Of your
parents? Absolutely, and if any of the siblings had written the book, they wouldn't... If my other siblings had written the book, the facts wouldn't have been different, but the story would have been.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because, and it's interesting, in a family
yeah.
where everyone shares things,
absolutely.
You come away with a different view of the family. Sometimes, mm-hmm. depending on where you are in the hierarchy, your relationship with each of those parents.
Absolutely. And my brother, the cop, the former cop, he just sees things a lot more in black and white. He said mm-hmm. becoming a parent made him less sympathetic to mom mm-hmm. and dad. He said, you know, it's not that hard to feed your kids. But then he said becoming a teacher made him appreciate mom and dad more. He said some of the things that some of his students mm-hmm. have not been given by their parents is staggering to him. He just sort of assumed right. that kids grow up learning the myths, the Greek myths, you know, and that's just not the case.
Well, I'm in the section where you're living in, I guess it's West Virginia, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and you're hungry once again and freezing in this little shack that you're
yes.
living in, mm-hmm. and your mother has snuck a bite of chocolate. I mean, that's where I am. And so the reason I call her neglectful is uh-huh. you kids are hungry.
The kids were hungry.
And she's sneaking a bite of chocolate.
It's funny that you're at that point because that is the point that many readers turned on mom. A lot of people said, your mom had me until the chocolate scene. You don't let your kids go hungry. And yeah, that was bad. And I actually wrestled with whether or not to include that scene because I could have easily left it out.
Sure.
But mom did that sort of thing a lot. And once the book came out and mom did finally read it, she said, she called up my sister, Lori, and she said, Jeanette wrote that you kids went hungry a lot. And Lori said, we did, Mom. And Lori started reminding her, and mom said, oh, yeah, I forgot. And she said, you know, I have a tendency to push unpleasant things out of my mind. And it's true. You know, it's a defense mechanism for her. But it also, I think, enabled her to not understand how truly bad things were for us kids. And I asked her about it at one point. She said, oh, kids are always complaining that they're hungry. But that's not the case, Mom.
No, it wasn't. But you think she has, and it's interesting, these are your parents.
Yeah.
So you love them.
Uh-huh.
You know, they raised you. I've never met them. I only know them through the book. And so
right.
I'm having, you know, probably a very different kind of reaction than you're having to.
No. I mean, my brother has a real problem with him. And I have a real, I understand that Mom had her limits. I understand. I just choose to sort of accept that this is who and what she is. She'll never be a normal mom.
Right.
I understand that. You know, she lives with me now. It's sort of like having a barn cat. You know, she's out there. She's amusing. I love her in a certain way. I don't love her the way that most folks love their mom because she's never was a source of comfort or protection for me. And she never will be. And if I sit around resenting that and want her to be somebody else, I'm going to turn bitter. So I just choose not to.
That was my 2009 interview with memoirist Jeanette Walls, whose first book, The Glass Castle, is in pre-production to become a movie. When we get back from the break, we'll hear the history of the board game Monopoly. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks again for joining us. How do you play Monopoly? Have you ever actually read the instructions, or do you play by the rules that your mom or childhood friend taught you? The game is so ubiquitous in American culture that many of us probably can't recall our introduction to the game or how we learned to play. Turns out Monopoly did not have an easy road to becoming the best-selling board game of all time. Author Mary Pallon delved into the dramatic and convoluted history of the game in her book, The Monopolists: Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. She joined us last year to tell us the backstory of the game and how it became such a hit. So were you an avid, competitive, brutal, cutthroat player?
I was. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, where it's cold and rainy, and you have a lot of time to sit inside and play board games and video games. So absolutely.
And which was your little piece that you played with? Did you have a favorite piece?
As a child, I played as the dog, and then as an adult, the thimble. But then they voted off the iron recently. So now I feel like, out of solidarity, you know, I should be playing as that more. So it's in flux.
So what do you think explains its popularity? And this is a game that has endured, you know, for decades now, through generations. I'm not sure how much it's played today in the, you know, in the world of the internet. But nonetheless, Monopoly is a very popular game.
Well, it's really interesting because I've wondered that a lot. And I think when Monopoly is a very strange game, because when you talk to people about it, they don't actually talk to you about the game. They talk about their memories playing it. They talk about their friends, their family. So it's much more about what we kind of project onto it. And it's always funny to ask people if they've ever read the Monopoly rules. And usually the answer is no. So it's a very unusual game in that it's very much passed down and kind of more of like an oral history tradition than, you know, a video game where you sit and try to figure your way through the whole thing.
And it is a game that has a lot of mythologies, maybe even sort of lies associated with it. When you get the game, there's a story about a guy named Charles Darrow, and who was this unemployed salesman and thought up this idea of Monopoly. Your book is really refuting that whole narrative.
Right, right. So the story for a long time that was told was that this man in Philadelphia, actually, Charles Darrow, had dreamed up the game in his basement during the Great Depression. He sells it to Parker Brothers. Parker Brothers as a company during the Great Depression was also on hard times. And Monopoly becomes this blockbuster and saves Darrow and the firm from the brink of destruction. But it turns out the roots of the game trace back to at least 30 years prior. Lizzie McGee was a left-wing feminist who made this game called The Landlord's Game. And she was an impassioned follower of Henry George, a big single tax guy. And she made it as a teaching tool. And the fact that in only, you know, a few decades, it became exactly the opposite, or associated with the opposite of what she was trying to teach, I find deliciously ironic.
Well, indeed. And you have pictures of what her game looked like.
Correct.
The Landlord's Game. And it looked sort of like Monopoly. But the idea was the opposite of Monopoly, which was to figure out how everyone, I guess everyone won. Was that
right,
the idea?
Right. So she makes two rule sets. She makes a monopolist rule set and an anti-monopolist rule set. And it's the monopolist rule set that really takes off. And the game, originally patented as Landlord's Game in 1904, it's not long before people start calling it the Monopoly game. And if you read her rules and a lot of her writings, she, like a lot of Georgists, were really concerned with monopolies at the time.
Right.
And this was part of just the political discourse. And sometimes they called themselves anti-monopolist. And it's the monopolist rule set that really takes off, and especially actually in Philly, and it flourishes in Northeast cities. So New York, Boston, and people localized the board and made it their own. But it was very much a political tool.
Well, and there was this, I guess, utopian society or place in Delaware, Arden,
right,
where people played her version of Monopoly.
Right. So Arden, Delaware was a big single tax hangout. It was frequented by Upton Sinclair, author of The Jungle, Scott Nearing, who had a very famous academic freedom case at Wharton. He spent time in Arden. And so it was very much passed around casually, and it kind of went viral, like turn of the century style. So her game kind of takes on a life of its own, and it evolves, and it's a version of that game that the Atlantic City Quakers embrace and then ultimately is sold to Parker Brothers.
And the Atlantic City Quakers, they put in the Marvin Gardens and all
the
names that we associate with Monopoly.
Exactly, exactly. Because they, like a lot of people, make the game their own. So, you know, if you're in Atlantic City, you're going to put Atlantic City properties on the board. And they also make some pretty important changes to the game. They make it simpler. They're playing it with children. A lot of teachers in Atlantic City are using it. So they put fixed prices on the board. There used to be a lot more auctioning in Monopoly. And, you know, silence is a tenet of the Quaker faith. So they don't really like the auctions. And they decide to get rid of that and make it simpler. So they make some tweaks to it. But if you look at Lizzie's original game, you can recognize things with Monopoly. I mean, there's go to jail. instead of free parking, you have free park because obviously cars aren't as big of a concern in 1904. And the Georgists were very concerned with public land and how it was used. So the railroads are there. So there are a lot of the key things that have still endured on the board today.
She's a fascinating person. And,
yes.
And was a stenographer. She worked in Washington, D.C.
Yes. She had many occupations throughout the year. She wrote poetry. She wrote short stories. She had appeared in some theater productions. She had worked as a stenographer. She also at one point worked at the Dead Letter Office, which I found fascinating because the Dead Letter Office was this place in D.C. where all the nation's unsent or, you know, lost correspondence went. And they employed a lot of women at the time, which was very progressive because they were thought to be more honest than men. So which is, you know, it was really fun to read a lot of these. I mean, it really wasn't that long ago, but she as a woman before women could vote was designing games. I mean, it was pretty unusual.
In fact, she had a patent.
Yes. Yes. She did have a patent.
Which is highly unusual for a woman to have a patent at the turn of the 20th century.
Correct. And her landlord's game wasn't even her first patent. In the 1890s, she had patented this typewriter gadget. So she her father was a very influential – James McGee was an influential newspaper owner, and he also had traveled with Abraham Lincoln during the Lincoln-Douglas debate. So – she's very much her father's daughter, and he infused a lot of her, you know, a lot of his political values in his daughter for sure.
She puts an ad in the newspaper for a young woman American slave. You include the ad. The ad reads like this: intelligent, educated, refined, true, honest, just, poetical, philosophical, broad-minded, and big-souled, and womanly above all things, brunette. Large gray-green eyes, full passionate lips, splendid teeth, not beautiful but very attractive, features full of character and strength, yet truly feminine, height 5'3", well-proportioned, graceful. In a sense, selling herself, or at least what she was trying, to make a point here, but nonetheless, selling herself in this ad.
Right. And this gets a lot of attention at the time. And she really did this, and she does a lot of interviews with various newspapers about what she kind of calls the slave stunt. And it's supposed to be a commentary about how women were paid at the time. And she was very frustrated. She had lived in Chicago and D.C. About how much she was being paid for the work she was doing. And she didn't have the same educational opportunities that she felt she deserved. So she was pretty audacious. I mean, that was pretty out there. And she a lot of people likened her to Mary McLean, who was an openly bisexual feminist of the time. So it was a time when, you know, women's rights was very much being talked about. But when you read the coverage of women at the time, I mean, people talk about their brains being smaller. And I mean, it's just like, it's crazy how out there she was considering what the thinking was at the time.
What was the response that she got to that ad?
So she got a lot of responses. And she, you know, when I read the ad too, I think there's a tinge of humor to it, like in sarcasm, which you kind of see in her game too, and a lot of her writings. And she gets a lot of responses, and she's very, some of them are serious and some of them aren't. And she's overwhelmed. But it definitely, if her goal was to get her name in headlines, she certainly did.
Now, it's interesting because she created two versions of Monopoly, one the more based on the ideas of Henry George, one the more sort of Monopoly that we would recognize today. That's the one that seemed to take off.
Correct. And you can read into human nature whatever you want, that's the one that we've all chosen.
And had an interesting, curious path through a university, some people that got interested in the game and sort of developed its more monopolistic I guess, philosophy or approach.
Right, right. And it's not surprising to me that the people that really loved the early folk game were people of a similar-ish political bent to her. So it became – and the idea of doing a board game as a teaching tool at this time was also not crazy. I mean, Milton Bradley was long established as a game maker, and he was one of the pioneers of the kindergarten movement in the United States. So board games had this kind of interesting – role. And remember, this is obviously before television. So the idea of somebody using a board game as a way to communicate political ideas completely makes sense. And she was following in a pretty strong tradition there.
You had mentioned Charles Darrow, and that's the name, I guess, that comes with the game today. And that's the sort of legend that he allegedly created this game. Help us understand a little bit more about him. He was a man that lived in Philadelphia, for one thing.
Yes. And by most accounts, really great family guy. I mean, I think that that's an important part of the story that and when I talk to people, I think he gets very villainized in this way that, you know, I don't know if it's entirely fair. It sounds like he was a really lovely guy. I think where it gets a little more controversial is when he sells the game to Parker Brothers they kind of go about acquiring these other competing games, and that they really kind of tell the story of him as an inventor. So and because he wasn't the only person selling the game. And actually now today, it's interesting, Hasbro, which has owned Parker Brothers since the early 90s, they now say, you know, it's the anniversary of the Monopoly brand, it's the anniversary of the purchase of the game. So, you know, because of the lawsuit in the 70s and a few other things, and as Lizzie's story has kind of slowly made its way out into especially the game historian community, you see some kind of massaging of things. But, you know, when I in my research, I looked at game catalogs, older editions of the games, and the Darrow story was just like the common default one for decades, no doubt.
You do include a letter where he's writing to Parker Brothers, and he talks about how his brainchild was born. I mean, he does take credit for creating this game, Monopoly.
And that's why I put the letter exchange in the book. I felt like people should decide what they think of him and the creation story. But I think something really important for context is this idea that Darrow, Lizzie McGee, Parker Brothers, none of these people knew they were sitting on Monopoly. I mean, a hit in the game industry is so rare, let alone a perennial, and one that we would be sitting here talking about. So, you know, I think it's easy for us to look back and say, this is good, this is bad, or, you know, black, white, gray, whatever the case may be. But I don't think anybody could have anticipated the incredible sales this game would have.
And he was poor at the time. This is during the Depression.
Correct.
He also had a child who was ill. So he needed the money.
Right. And I think that there's something to be said for needing money versus needing millions and millions of dollars. I think that the motives, again, and when we kind of one of the things I find interesting about historical writing is you really have to get into your characters' heads and think about it in real time as it's unfolding.
Right.
Because that's how these things actually happen. They don't happen with us sitting back and looking on the 30s. So with Darrow, I really tried to kind of peel back his history as happening in real time and the decisions he was making. And it made me think, you know, it's not as crazy as, oh, he just stole this idea from a woman. Because by that point, you know, the Atlantic City Quakers, when the Darrow Monopoly story really starts taking off, they talk about later, like, well, we tried to correct the record, but we didn't invent it either.
Right.
You know, so by the time they're playing the game, the game has kind of traveled beyond her being associated with it. So, you know, the history's already muddled at that point, which is before Parker Brothers even buys the game. So I think it's a little more complicated for sure.
But playing the game for days on end, and that can be done, Mary.
Oh, and people play it. I mean, my brother and I played like that all the time. I mean, I think that what's so funny to me about Monopoly is that people make it their own thing. And it's very much a folk game still. Like, to that point, nobody reads the rules and house rules and people adding and modifying things. So if you want to play for many days at a time, like, rock on. You know, like, that's fantastic.
Does anyone know how many games of Monopoly have been sold?
We have no idea. I mean, especially what's tricky about that number, too, is first of all, Hasbro doesn't break it out. But also, there's so many variations of the game now that I think that it's safe to say it's among the most successful commercially sold games. I mean, Scrabble at one point was outpacing it in the 50s, but all told, I mean, who knows how many Monopoly sets are out there, my gosh.
And interestingly, it became popular during the Depression, during the 1930s.
Right.
And I guess, I mean, talk about a kind of, you know, fantasy escapist game for people that were struggling to make a living.
Right. And board games have this very interesting cyclical trend, which is that they do well during downturns. And I don't know what the reason exactly is for that. I mean, one thing is it's a cheap form of entertainment.
Sure.
So I think there's something, especially we saw that in 2008. But I think that there is kind of an irony to that, especially Monopoly's case. And I think that board games in general, not to get too philosophical, but they're about role playing and they're about fantasy and they're about doing things in real life doing things that we can't do in real life. So I think, you know, as a kid, and I'm not the only one, you know, Monopoly's really exciting because you get to kind of play grown up in a way. And unless you're Donald Trump, you know, you don't get to like throw around real estate and money like quite like that as an adult even. So I think that's part of why the game has endured for sure.
Although when you look at what's happening in Atlantic City now,
it's sort of
a slightly different tale. What's interesting, too, is during World War II, the Monopoly game board was used to send information, documents, maps?
Right. So as I was researching this, over and over again, I heard this story that Monopoly boards were being used to send escape aids to POWs during World War II. So compasses, silk maps, and Waddington's, who had published the British flavor of the game. You know, I'd heard that they and British Secret Service were working on this. And what frustrated me about this and still does is that there were no surviving boards, or at least I couldn't find any. And that I thought if Monopoly boards were being used to save people, people would be talking about this. You know, this is an amazing story. There's only a couple of accounts that I could find. And I talked to a lot of military historians about this. Like, was this feasible? Did this happen? And I ended up, you know, I'm not sure if Monopoly boards, you know, and some of these like grandiose claims that came later, like, you know, if it weren't for Monopoly, like, you know, like nobody was saying Monopoly saved my life. Like, so it just seemed like there was, you know, fact and PR kind of diverged a little bit.
Right.
But it did crack open this kind of interesting role that games play during war and that Churchill and others talked about, especially for prisoners of war, you know, the stigma associated with that and the idea that people were thinking of them from the outside and that they needed things to pass the time. And actually, Milton Bradley during the Civil War had sent games to the war front. So that was an interesting piece to me psychologically. And actually, I've heard from folks in Iraq and Afghanistan about video games. And so we have this interesting tradition of, you know, really awful wars, but having access to games for people in the middle of it seems to be this kind of interesting theme.
Do you see the game Monopoly kind of reflecting those certain generations or important moments or times in history?
I think so. And I think that by the time the war comes in, you know, the 1940s, Monopoly had been around for a while. And it's very much for a lot of Americans, something associated with home. And then when people when the soldiers come back and you have kind of the rise of suburbia, Monopoly boxes become ubiquitous. I mean, you want a new fridge, you want a new car, and you throw Monopoly in your closet.
Absolutely.
You know, it's so that's really, I think, the timing of all this and kind of how it weaves its way in history is interesting as well.
This book is also about who, you know, how things get invented. And as you said, it isn't really necessarily, it's the rare thing that is the light bulb. I mean, maybe the light bulb is the light bulb. But many inventions often have many parents, if I can put it that way.
Right. And I think, you know, you were asking why did we not know about Lizzie McGee? And I think that one of the headwinds against her is the romance of the Darrow story. I mean, whether it's true or not, it's a beautiful story. And I think that's something that we all love and we all cling to. And it's very American, too, this idea, you know, the Cinderella element of it, I think, is something. I mean, there's so many examples of that in our culture. And we love that. And so if you're not, you know, the Cinderella story, I mean, that's really tough to go up against. And I thought that was interesting, too, that even after Ralph's lawsuit, which ended in 1983, and he had found, you know, kind of the guts of this, that, you know, that Lizzie McGee had originated the game, that still, you know, here I am in 2015. Right. And I can't tell you how many people say, oh, Monopoly, it was invented during the Great Depression. And I'm like, no, you know, so it's amazing to me how much that has stuck, that invention story.
That was my 2015 interview with Mary Pallon, author of The Monopolists. When we get back from the break, we'll get some music and conversation with Grammy Award-winning guitarist Jason Veo. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Coaim. We close out today's show with a little music. Last year, we were joined by Jason Veo following his Grammy win for Best Classical Instrumental Soloist in 2015. The award was for his album Play, which is filled with diverse selections from Spanish guitar to Duke Ellington compositions. He brought his guitar to our WHYY studios to give us a taste of his playing, as well as to discuss his influences, his method, and his early experiences performing music. We'll begin with his in-studio performance of the song Misionera by composer Fernando Bustamante.
Thank you.
That was great. I'm speechless. Jason Vio playing a song called Misionera, composed by the Argentine composer Fernando Bustamante. I'm looking at your album here. This is from Play. And you also give a bit of a shout-out to composer Jorge Morel.
Yes, because Jorge is the arranger of that. So that's a song, basically, in Argentina. And Jorge is a great classical guitarist from Argentina who's lived in New York since the early 60s. And I was really fortunate to take a couple lessons from him when I was a teenager, growing up in Buffalo and then again in Cleveland, when I moved to Cleveland to go to the Cleveland Institute of Music to study. And those interactions with him as a teacher were really important for me. And he gave me a lot of freedom in the sense to say, like, oh, you know, these are just kind of, this is the arrangement that's on the score, but you could do this, and you could do this. And, you know, so
have fun with it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You have your guitar, and I'm just curious about what kind of guitar you play.
Yeah.
You know, so that people.
Yeah, well,
about that.
Yeah, the classical guitar is similar. There are some similarities to what we see a lot on television, an acoustic guitar. Sometimes when, you know, a singer-songwriter, if you see, like, that kid on The Voice, you know, that's a steel-string guitar. But Sting, you know, we've seen other performers like Sting and Eric Clapton, Tears in Heaven. He's playing actually a classical guitar, and that's a Spanish-origin guitar with nylon strings on it. So that's basically, you know, the simple answer is it's that. But the one I'm playing, of course, is a very... you know, very good one made by a German luthier in
Frankfurt. Quite an understatement there, I'm sure.
So his name is Gernot Wagner, and it's a really wonderful instrument.
Yeah. Can I see your hands?
Sure.
Do you have long fingernails? Oh, you just on your thumb.
Just on the thumb, because my thumb is actually quite a lot shorter, actually, than my fingers. So I have, I try to craft a longer thumbnail than we use four of the five fingers on the right hand as plectrums because you know as you can hear in Misionera we're playing that's a three part texture so we're playing three parts at the same time. The thumb can play a bass line
right
and then my index and middle fingers you know kind of play a little bit of a sort of a rhythmic glue in the middle. And then my ring finger plays the melody. Like this.
Yeah.
So we're doing we're playing a lot more notes and a lot more texture than the typical guitarist. So it requires a lot
Indeed.
Of training and when you're little, you know.
Another
a kid.
Understatement if I can put it that way. So when did you pick up your first guitar? How old were you?
Well, my mother brought one home one day when I was 5 and I didn't really study anything on it. I just goofed around on it and did take some music reading lessons, almost kind of like an early music theory course, summer course, with jazz guitarist Joel Perry, who performs regularly in New York. And he was living in Buffalo at the time. And so I learned how to read, write, and sing solfege using the guitar as kind of like, instead of the piano as the instrument. But I didn't really learn like pieces at that time. And then when the Buffalo Guitar Quartet came to my school for an outreach concert, my mother happened to be working there as a secretary for the library, which was very fortunate because I would have enjoyed that concert and then went to my classes and, you know, and not really thought of, oh, you know, I really want to study with these guys. But, you know,
she knew
she was. Yeah, because I had the guitar around and I was playing things by ear and, you know. And so she said, I think he's got a really great ear. He loves music, sings harmony parts to the Beatles records. And you know,
and there was a lot of Beatles music growing up, right?
Yeah. I loved them. So that's how I started. So when I actually started practicing and taking lessons, it was classical guitar and music and etudes and exercises right from the very beginning with Jeremy Sparks.
So what kind of, besides the Beatles, what kind of music did you grow up listening to?
The record collection was really on my mom's records were all, you know, rock and roll and soul, like soul, R&B, Stax, you know, Motown, all the good stuff, right? And my dad had only modern jazz records. He was not a fan of popular music, you know. So it was,
and then not a lot of classical music then.
But they didn't really have many. I think they had a Gershwin. They had Bernstein in New York, Phil doing like Gershwin, like American in Paris.
Right.
Like that was about it, you know. But then once I started learning the classical repertoire, the Spanish pieces, Bach, then my father especially really just completely just fell head over heels for classical music, and I think after that he almost listened exclusively to that. It's interesting.
Well, I'd love to have you play another piece. Speaking of pop, Oh, What a Wonderful World. Was absolutely beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
As you said, that's your arrangement.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to just make arrangements of things if a song either pops into my head. When I'm home, you know, I have a 1-year-old, and we watch Sprout Channel a lot, so I end up making arrangements of all these kind of theme songs that are on these Sprout Channel television shows. So stuff like that. I've always done that, you know, just kind of made up an arrangement by ear. And also now in professional situations, I'm end up doing that a lot with my collaborators.
Now, were you in rock band? I mean, when you were a kid, a young man with a guitar in high school? I mean,
well,
does it get much cooler than that?
Yeah, well, I sort of blew that opportunity, actually. I was very much, I didn't even really, I was sort of oblivious to that, those possibilities that we now as adults, of course, understand, like, the guitar, the whole guitar thing, you know, rock and roll or singer-songwriter type of thing. But, you know, I was so focused by the time I was 12, 13, 14, I was so into it, you know, so into the practicing, and I did it very much on my own. It was very much my own thing. You know, my parents really sort of
left it up to
observed
you
it.
Mike?
Yeah, they really just wanted to support it, but it was never. We didn't know anything about it. We were just all kind of caught up in it. We were learning about it as we went along, learning about the repertoire, learning about the great international players that would come through Rochester, Buffalo, and hold a master class. You know, so we didn't even really know that there was like a potential there until the international players like David Russell or Pepe Romero would Carlos Barbosa Lima, Leona Boyd would tell my parents and my teacher, like, well, yeah, he's
really good.
Yeah, sort of like almost like a basketball prospect, you know, a scout or a coach or someone saying like, no, he's, definitely keep him doing what he's doing . And to me, it was just something I loved doing.
And what, clearly
you're excellent at what you do, and you clearly love it. I mean, was it kind of love at first sight, where you just sort of felt like this instrument that can make this sound is something that really speaks to me?
I think so. I think there must have been some kind of thing like that, but it wasn't a rapturous kind of thing. It was more like I just wanted to get my lesson prepared, for the next week. I was very sort of industrious about it. I would just prepare the next set of things and then just keep moving. Then when you started playing pieces, when you got to the level after a couple of years of studies and exercises and you were playing, bigger pieces, then it's really kind of took hold, especially when you would play for somebody and you get this kind of sort of almost like this early audience interaction kind of thing going. And then it started to become more of a real, thing.
Well, I mean, you're playing, a couple feet away from me. So, I get an up close look at you as you perform. And I always wonder with musicians sort of where when they are performing and performing at such a high level, what are they thinking?
Well,
where is their brain?
I've played with a lot of great musicians around the world and have lots of friends that are musicians. And I think they think different things. Especially at a high level, I think of jazz playing, jazz improvisation, classical music playing, classical music performance. Everybody has to kind of find their own way to get there, get to that place where you can really focus and concentrate. And I think for different players, it's different sort of things. For me, it's just if I'm just listening, I feel like I'm a listener along with the audience. If I get into when I'm in that mode where I'm not judging while I'm playing, then and I'm just kind of observing and just listening to the music and enjoying it, that's really nice. That's kind of where I tend to stay.
I mean, that's kind of a nice zen-ish place to be, isn't it? Where you play without judgment.
Yeah, if you can. It's hard not to, but the thing is, the judgment stuff has to. So I do all my worrying and stressing out way before the concert.
Oh, is that right? Like days before?
Like weeks and months. Oh. So it's in the preparation of the pieces because, it takes a couple months to prepare, say, a 5-minute piece. To really play it well and to take it through all of its kind of performance process, a new one, something that's new. So it's, and I'm playing a lot of new, different music all the time. So that's the time when I'm sort of more like, okay, I've already got it sort of organized in my head as far as how long it's going to take to prepare it.
That again was my 2015 interview with classical guitarist Jason Viau. He's performing for an event for WHYY on Thursday, May 26th. For information, go to member services at whyy.org. We close out our conversation with a song from his Grammy Award-winning album. It's called El Colibri by Julio Segreras. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.